which is actually to maybe the three speakers in this session. I'd like to go back to, I guess Jim Plummer has left. So he made this, he has left?
Yes.
Can I still quote him?
So especially now.
He said this morning that engineers, quote, engineers build things in simulations by themselves, build nothing. And when I see 6,000 people a year using atomistic, and he was talking about atomistic simulations, what's coming out of these if they're not building something? Can you comment? It sure seems, from what I'm hearing in this session, that things are being built, but in what way? And maybe just I'd like to get people's take on that kind of sentence. I think it's an interesting one.
Well, I guess since I've got the microphone, I'll respond. But you can't summarize. I mean, it's difficult to summarize what N thousand applications actually cover. There's a lot of academic research. There's a lot of industrial research, quite a bit of which isn't published. There are certainly known success stories that either float around the conference circuit or elsewhere where computational quantum chemistry has helped people design things. So we know, for example, that DuPont, in its replacement of chlorofluorocarbons in the early 90s, relied very strongly on quantum chemistry calculations, not just to predict the properties of the materials and how they'd behave in the atmosphere, but also even to consider how to build the plant and so forth. Another example is a zirconosine catalyst developed by Dow, which is considered to have had critical input from computation. So there's a lot of stuff going on industrially that uses this as a tool that complements any other experimental tool or any other simulation tool, and we shouldn't be surprised about that. These methods can be used by engineers when appropriate and by scientists when appropriate. I think the majority of usage is by scientists, but...
Well, you mentioned experimental assembly. Yeah. That makes me think building is probably happening.
Yeah, well, the majority of our users are experimentalists.
I didn't prepare a list of examples, but I can say, at least for our specific case of carbon, say that the current ICF capsule design is based on our EOS model that we developed from first principles, and that's really what it's based on. And that's a prediction that we're making that it will work, and you'll find out, I guess, if it really was successful in design. But that's actually producing something. It's producing an EOS model that's being used to design this capsule. Without it, there wouldn't have any way to do it.
I could cite an example that isn't a first principles one, but I think had a big impact, and that is that in the world of making thin films for the microelectronics, going way back, people used very complex reactor geometries, often had two- and three-dimensional flows, really difficult to model. And somewhere along the line, I think in about the mid-80s, some fluid mechanics people said, hey, if you guys would just do your experiments in a stagnation flow reactor, we could model that really easily with a lot of complex chemistry, and maybe you could figure out what's going on there. Well, in fact, people did that. They built experimental reactors, and about the same time, the tool makers figured this out too. And so now, if you go to any CMOS fab, you'll see all kinds of stagnation flow reactors. So it's an example of where some understanding of fundamental science, in this case fluid mechanics, was able to guide process development.
Can I make a comment on when experimentalists using a simulation software, there is first part, one part of the story. Because you may remember, Leo, one of the bad examples you were citing in the morning, not that any of this in here, out of the 6,000. But I'm saying one of the examples he was showing was this solenum. But how is it pronounced? This
solenum.
Yes. And he was saying that it was used in an interpretive mode, using a parameter that was 10 times out, and therefore the simulation was not good. So many times when an experimentalist is already ready to write a paper, many times they use a simulation to sort of get a few pictures and insert it to sort of support their point of view. I think a better use would be that using the simulator, if they said that, okay, if this is true, if I have understood it, then this must be true, and therefore have done the second experiment, is only in that way a simulation is validated and useful. So simply using simulators in an interpretive mode is not good enough. So I think that is the distinction I wanted to make.
That's reasonable, but it is very important to also understand that simulations can be used for insight and in an explanatory mode as well. And furthermore, the kinds of atomistic simulations we're talking about here have no adjustable parameters. In other words, you get what you get, good, bad, or ugly, but nothing is adjustable. And so if the agreement with experiment is good, then you can go on to perhaps interpret the experiment, for instance, in terms of, you know, what is my bottleneck in the reaction, what is the transition state, and the sort of thing that's not directly experimentally accessible, or perhaps even go on to then, from insight like that, to then consider what would a substituent effect be if I then make a chemical modification to my system. I should now have some handle with which to do that next experiment. So I agree with part of what you say, but I think the interpretive mode and model is very important.
Without any adjustable parameter, the experiment is adjustable. Every time I have a different material I put in, so it's a different material, like a polysilicon, if you do a slightly different processing, it's a different thing. So if you have no adjustable parameter, how are you going to compare with experiment?
Well, the atoms change, but I'm saying that the functional, the treatment of the electronic structure is a given approximation to the Schrodinger treatment. It's not the real quantum mechanics, but it's a good approximation to it. And aside from the input of atoms and numbers of electrons and a basis set to attach to each atom, which has nothing to do with the molecule itself, nothing else is adjusted. So you get what you get at the end. If you change the molecule, you change the outcome, and you see whether or not the predictions of your theoretical model chemistry match nature's chemistry or not.
So you said many of your users are experimentalists. How do you disseminate the software to them? Do they have friendly interfaces? Do you have tutorials?
It's predominantly commercial software, and it does have friendly interfaces. You point and click to build a molecule. You then press the submit button to run the job. You get your outputs that go straight into a spreadsheet. And so it's quite a friendly environment. And of course, if you're an uncritical user, you can readily generate bad numbers by inappropriate choices of method or basis set. But
so the code is proprietary.
Well, there's a range of codes. Some are public domain, some are proprietary. I'm a developer of a proprietary code. We consider it to be open source amongst our developers and closed source to everybody else. That's the basic mode in which we operate. And when you have a community of hundreds of developers and tens of thousands of users, that's a reasonable trade-off, in my view at any rate.
In the field of quantum chemistry, though, is it the amount that has been adopted by, say, experimentalists, does this have more to do with the ease of use or just the realization of how powerful a tool it really is?
I think one has to assume both, right? It's possible to use it, and it turns out to be useful to use it. And it would not have this continuing growth were the results not useful.
I just have one more question. In the case of the catalytic intermediate states that you said were able to be revealed by this kind of computation, would you cast that as experimentalists using the modeling to understand their experiments?
Yes, and as a basis for then going on to consider how to design better catalysts. In the case of a homogeneous catalyst, you typically have a metal center that's active, surrounded by sort of organic spinach, and you kind of modify the chemical surroundings in order to accomplish the catalytic goal. And if you understand what are the bottlenecks, what are the key intermediate states, you can get some idea. That example I showed you actually led to the conclusion that that particular catalyst could not be improved because there were two bottleneck steps with almost equal barriers, and changing the organic substituents could tune one but not the other. And that's the kind of conclusion that experimentally all that was known was that that particular ligand, PCA ligand in that case, happened to be the best that had been found.
It's 5:45.
Was there one more question?
I just had a curiosity. How does look your 1 million line legacy look in the brave new world of massive parameterization?
Well, I guess we're going to find out. But right now it's parallel by MPI, and that in our hands means modestly parallel, maybe up to 64 processors or so with good scaling, to be honest, and beyond that, not too worthwhile. And a lot of our more advanced methods, we develop them in scalar mode, serial mode, because until they're mature, why should we invest lots of effort in developing parallel code? So we would very much like to, I guess, echo the comment that you made earlier, that to the extent that we could have software tools that would enable us to adopt as seamlessly as possible improvements in computer hardware, that would be great. And at the library level, it is seamless. We all use LAPACK and ScalarPACK. At higher levels, MPI is, we live with it, but we don't really like it.
Maybe the last question.
In a sense, is in your field non-equilibrium at all important of transport and chemical reactions and things? It seems like everything is equilibrium, number one. Number two is, I sometimes say it's the art is in the cutting, right? What can you chop out and still get decent answers? And the way I can do a million atom simulations is I don't do chemistry, I chop out all the core stuff and do things in the conduction and valence band, right? Is there any trend in your world to do something similar, that you don't do an all-electron and...
So let me respond to those serially. So with respect to equilibrium versus non-equilibrium, essentially what the output of a quantum chemistry code is the input to a treatment of kinetics. And so, in fact, in order to examine the overall turnover rate for a catalyst like that, you really are building up the elementary reaction steps, and then you're faced with a set of coupled ordinary differential equations, and you may have sort of pre-equilibria. All the things that come up in kinetics have to be treated next. So equilibrium versus non-equilibrium, kinetics is really handling the non-equilibrium case. With respect to chopping and cutting, it's done reasonably ubiquitously, both with respect to removing irrelevant core electrons and replacing them with effective core potentials, and also with respect to modeling, say, the active site of things like enzymes with tens of thousands of atoms, replacing those with perhaps on the order of 100 key atoms, and then trying to embed that in an environment maybe of point charges or something much simplified. So the sort of divide and conquer approaches to multi-scale modeling are sort of already being used, but I think it's fair enough to say that there's a frontier in terms of doing things a bit more systematically in terms of multi-scale.
I'm going to turn it over to the organizers and wrap it up. Thanks.
Thank you. I guess I don't really have much else to say except, Mark, do you have anything to say? I mean, dinner is served whenever we get there. And I guess there are probably a couple of taxis. Yeah. I think.
Let me just make sure.
Okay. We think there probably are. And
They didn't leave. They have no
thanks
sense.
To everybody for a really very inspiring workshop.
And maybe I can thank everybody once again, too, for spending the day with us. I'm not sure what the conclusion is, but you've given us a lot to think about. That's what the objective
but, was. But we started by saying there shouldn't necessarily be a conclusion. So we're okay. But,
so I have one question that I want you to think about, maybe while we chat over there. We've heard from, I think, three different communities of people. We've heard from computer scientists and applied mathematicians and people who are struggling with how you develop algorithms for multi-cores and other problems, not particularly focused on specific physical problems. And then we've heard of a group of people that are working on grand challenges and specific physical and chemical electronic problems. And then we've heard a few people talk or advocate more small-scale simulation. And my question is all of this computational sciences? Do all of these people belong in the same room? How do they work together? Should they work together? Can they benefit? If so, how? So if you have ideas on that, are we going to have...
Over a glass of wine.
Please.
For those of you who are going to...